Welcome to the Studying the Bible podcast, where every Thursday, Pastors Dylan Dodson and Brian Androsian study a book of the Bible, verse by verse, to see what is being communicated and how we can use it to grow in our relationship with Jesus. We pray that today's podcast can help you grow just a little bit closer to Christ.
Well, welcome back to our Bible study through the book of Habakkuk. Today in this session, we're going to be in Habakkuk chapter 2, starting at verse 6, going through verse 20. Just to give a recap from the last session, from the beginning of chapter 2. What we saw at the beginning of chapter 2 is we saw Habakkuk waiting on God's response to his second prayer, and we saw the beginning of God's response. So we saw that what we kind of talked about is how God's timing is perfect and ours isn't, even if that means waiting for an unknown amount of time. You know, we saw at the beginning of the chapter, we saw Habakkuk waiting patiently, that we covered a couple sessions ago, waiting patiently on God's response, even though it was really dire situation that he was waiting on, a dire response that he was waiting on. But having faith that God will move is the mark of a righteous person, even if it doesn't come in our own timing. So we saw God reference Babylon's wickedness and how, despite the fact that they kind of swallowed up everything in their path now, their greed and arrogance will eventually be their downfall. So that's where we were in the first couple verses, first handful of verses in chapter 2. Now today we're going to be moving into the next part of his response in chapter 2, starting in verse 6. So starting in verse 6, we get what's called the five woe oracles. If you remember back to the beginning, oracle, another way to look at it, or another kind of translation for it, is a burden. So these are kind of like the five burdens burdens that were kind of placed on Habakkuk, the prophet, by God. So in these oracles, God is speaking on behalf of the nations that Babylon has oppressed. And so as we kind of get into it, we're actually going to rewind one verse, go back to verse 5, read that, then we're going to move on into verse 6. So Habakkuk chapter 2, starting in verse 5, what it says is, it says, "Moreover, wine betrays. An arrogant man is never at rest. He enlarges his appetite like Sheol, and like death, he is never satisfied. He gathers all the nations to himself. He collects all the peoples for himself." So as a reminder, God is talking about Babylon here and how swiftly they gather up other people and nations for themselves. Now, as we continue into verse 6, he's speaking on behalf of those people that he's referred to as being collected up by Babylon for themselves. So he's speaking on behalf of those people that Babylon has been kind of collecting and gathering up for themselves. So moving into verse 6. "Won't all of these take up a taunt against him with mockery and riddles about him? They will say, 'Woe to him who amasses what is not his. How much longer?' And loads himself with goods taken in pledge." So although people are being oppressed by Babylon, what we're kind of seeing is that eventually, they'll eventually be able to kind of speak up against Babylon. They will eventually be able to rise up against Babylon. Although Babylon seems all-powerful at the time, there'll come a day that those that are oppressed by them will be able to speak out against them. And this section is kind of saying what they will say and what they will do. So though Babylon is being specified in this instance, obviously that's the situation that we're talking about, this message is not just for Babylon, but it's kind of to anybody that oppresses somebody else. So this can be really relevant for us to read today. It's not, while it's given in a specific circumstance, it's not just about Babylon. It's about anyone who kind of oppresses someone who's weaker than them. The one who amasses what is not his, as it says, is referring to Babylon, but not just because they steal and they plunder the nations that they conquer, not just because they're physically taking things, but the nations that they overcome were considered to be kind of like in Babylon's debt, and the things that Babylon stole and plundered and took from them were seen as kind of like collateral for this debt. Now, the reality is that this collateral would never actually be returned, because these nations had no way of repaying the debt that Babylon imposed on them or claimed that they owed. But that was kind of the situation, or that's kind of the way that Babylon and that these nations were kind of looking at it. So in other words, Babylon was oppressing these nations physically and financially, and they were setting up these systems that made it impossible for them to have their belongings returned. And so that's what's being referred to here as when it says it loads himself with goods taken in pledge. So continue on to verse 7. It says, "Won't your creditors suddenly arise, and those who disturb you wake up? Then you will become spoil for them." So this is an indication that eventually the tables will turn. Eventually the tables will turn, and those who are oppressed will eventually rise up and overcome or overthrow Babylon. Now, the oppressed are spoils for the oppressor. However, one day, the oppressor will become spoils for the oppressed. So this is telling them that eventually the tables will turn or the tides will turn, and the ones who are being oppressed now will end up being the ones that are oppressing the oppressor. So we continue in verse 8. It says, since you have plundered many nations, all the people who remain will plunder you because of human bloodshed and violence against land, cities, and all who live in them. So verses 6 through 8 go together, and they're the first woe, the first of the five woes that we're going to talk about. Those who the oppressor plunders will eventually plunder them. There will be no oppressor who does not have to live with eventually being oppressed. We're going to be talking a lot about how kind of the tables being turned and how the things that Babylon is or oppressors are doing to the people that they're oppressing are eventually going to happen back to them. This is a message about what will eventually happen to Babylon. Those that Babylon oppresses will eventually turn and oppress them because of the violence that they committed against these weaker nations. As we continue through verses 9 through 11, then we move into the second of the five woes. So starting in verse 9, it says, woe to him who dishonestly makes wealth for his house to place his nest on high to escape the grasp of disaster. So in Hebrew, this verse literally reads like this. It says, woe to the one cutting off an evil cut for his house to set on high his nest to save himself from the hand of evil. So cutting off an evil cut kind of refers to as cheating a customer, so cheating somebody else. So what this verse is saying is it's saying, woe to him who commits the evil act of cheating somebody else to save himself from evil. So woe to him who kind of does this evil act with the purpose of saving himself or putting himself kind of higher up to save himself from having evil committed against him. And one commentary I read makes a reference here to the English phrase to make a killing, and how kind of poetically appropriate it is here, as they were making gains at the expense of others. They're making a killing, quite literally, at the expense of others. Earning money and gaining wealth isn't necessarily evil unless it comes at the hands of cheating or harming somebody else. We continue in verse 10. It says, you have planned shame for your house by wiping out many peoples and sinning against your own self. So the harm that the oppressor causes to other people will eventually be the reason that harm comes to themselves. And a similar sentiment, if we read the book of Proverbs, a similar sentiment is referenced there in Proverbs 8:36. It says, but the one who misses me or sins against me harms himself. All who hate me love death. So the Babylonians are going to be the fall of Babylon because of their own evil and because of their own oppression. Their oppression are going to be the reason that they are overcome. Continue in verse 11. It says, for the stones will cry out from the wall, and the rafters will answer them from the woodwork. So multiple times in the Old Testament, we see inanimate objects that are personified to show God's creation responding in the way that God responds to a situation. And in this case, as one commentator puts it, he says, the building is so much the result of wickedness that even its materials cannot forego protest. So everything they have and everything that they gather and gain comes at the hand of wickedness. And so much so that it's saying that even God's creation that's being gathered and amassed for wickedness can't help but protest against them. So verses 9 through 11 addressed those that oppress people financially specifically is what we're talking about. Because of their oppression, the same is going to happen to them. And so verse 12 through 14, as we continue on, contains the next of the five woes. Starting in verse 12. Says, woe to him who builds a city with bloodshed and founds a town with injustice. So building a city on bloodshed or founding a town on injustice refers to the Babylonian habit of taking prisoners of war and forcing them into hard labor, forcing them to build cities and towns. So quite literally, these towns are built on bloodshed. These cities are built on bloodshed. And he's saying, woe to him who builds a city at the expense of other people, who uses someone else's pain and blood and life to build something for themselves. Verse 13, is it not from the Lord of armies that the peoples labor only to fuel the fire and countries exhaust themselves for nothing? So this question that's kind of posed here is being asked rhetorically, obviously, but it's saying that those that are laboring and exhausting themselves for Babylon are doing so in vain. And if we look at the book of Jeremiah, we see something kind of similar. In Jeremiah 51:58, says, this is what the Lord of armies says. Babylon's thick walls will be totally demolished and her high gates set ablaze. The peoples will have labored for nothing and the nations will weary themselves only to feed the fire. So God's judgment here, what we're seeing is God's judgment here will come on those that are laboring for their own glory rather than laboring for the glory of God. So all this work that Babylon is putting in, they're doing all this for their own selfish gain. So God is saying that that judgment is going to come on those that are laboring only for themselves, which is what Babylon is doing, and not laboring for the Lord. Verse 14, for the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the Lord's glory as the water covers the sea. So here we see God addressing, kind of like going back and addressing Habakkuk's complaint, but maybe not in the way that he would expect. God's main goal is for the world to know him. His main goal isn't punishment. So as Habakkuk is in Judah, and as Babylon is going to be he's learning that Babylon's going to be approaching, I'm sure it could have been easy for him to look at it and think that he wants God to punish Babylon for what they're doing. Originally, he was talking about the evils of Judah, but now talking about the evils of Babylon, and he would want God to punish them for what he was doing. And what we're kind of seeing that's what God's going to do eventually. Obviously, this is far down the road, but that's what God is going to do eventually, but that's not his main goal. His main goal is for everyone to know him. His main goal isn't just to seek out those that have done wrong and punish them, but his main goal is that everyone, regardless of who they are, would come to know him. And when we talk about knowing God, we aren't talking about just having knowledge of God or having knowledge about God. Rather, knowing God is having a deep and personal relationship with him. This is what God desires. This is what we're seeing. Then as we move on to verse 15, verses 15 through 17 contain the next of the five woes. So we move on to verse 15. And it says, "Woe to him who gives his neighbors drink, pouring out your wrath and even making them drunk in order to look at their nakedness." So what's going on here in this verse is kind of using something that would happen literally to make a figurative point. So Babylon was known for the drunkenness. They were known for the drinking, which would lead to parties, which would lead to orgies. And so a reference to their drunkenness and nakedness when referring to Babylon, it would have resonated with people. That people in Judah or people that knew Babylon would have kind of understood this is something that Babylon does. And their love for getting drunk is being used as a comparison for what they would do to other nations here. So just in the example, or kind of in verse 15, what it says, just as getting your neighbor drunk to take advantage of them, which is essentially what it's saying, how that's referenced here, Babylon would similarly take advantage of these other nations, and which would bring shame on them. So in Israel, when nakedness is talked about, nakedness would symbolize shame. And so Babylon is being referenced as one who would kind of take advantage of others. Not kind of. I mean, it would quite literally take advantage of others, forcing them to bring shame on themselves. As we move into verse 16, it says, "You will be filled with disgrace instead of glory. You also drink and expose your uncircumcision. The cup in the Lord's right hand will come around to you, and utter disgrace will cover your glory." So although Babylon sees himself as glorious, they're soon going to be disgraced. So Babylon's drunkenness and drinking and exposing their uncircumcision, what this is talking about, this is kind of a reversal from what they do to others in verse 15. So in verse 15, it talks about how they treat others, and in verse 16, it talks about how that's going to be kind of reversed on them. Now, they will be the ones who are exposed and shamed, just like how they exposed and shamed others. And at this time, what's going on here, only God's chosen people practice circumcision, and the Babylonians didn't. So that's why it says that their uncircumcision will be exposed. In addition to being exposed and shamed, so they would be exposed, they would be shamed, but in addition to that, exposing their uncircumcision means that it will be exposed that they are not people that are part of God's covenant. So saying, just as you kind of disgrace people, as you take advantage of them and shame them, in the same way, you are going to be shamed. And in doing so, it'll be revealed that you are not God's chosen people. You are not a part of God's covenant. In verse 17, it says, "For your violence against Lebanon will overwhelm you. The destruction of animals will terrify you because of your human bloodshed and violence against lands, cities, and all who live in them." So in this verse, a specific instance of Babylon's oppression is referenced, talking about Lebanon and Lebanon's destruction at the hand of the Babylonians. Now, this being brought up isn't just chosen at random. It's not as if just one random nation or one random region that Babylon conquered is now being brought into the picture, but Lebanon is brought up for a very specific reason. See, to conquer Lebanon was seen as a massive accomplishment. So Lebanon had these large forests that had these cedars in them, and having the steady supply of these cedars, these trees, these cedars, was extremely useful for Babylon's building projects. So it's not just another nation to conquer, but they actually had this resource in these cedars that would have been really helpful for any other nation to have. Because of its forests and mountains, conquering Lebanon would have been extremely difficult. So they were not an easy place to conquer, and they had these resources that have been extremely valuable, so conquering Lebanon would have been something to kind of brag about, to boast about, that they were the ones to do it. And when it talks about this claim that the destruction of animals will terrify them, what that probably means, likely means one of two things, or both. It could be a reference to the death of animals due to the death of animals that were used to haul these cedars from Lebanon to Babylon, or it could be in reference to the death of animals that would have been caused by Babylon's kind of deforestation of Lebanon and taking these cedars and kind of disrupting the habitat that these animals lived in and the death of the animals that would have come from that. But it's referencing Babylon conquering Lebanon as this massive feat of accomplishment. That's the way it would have been seen as this massive accomplishment. But it's saying that your violence against Lebanon will overwhelm you. As we move into 18 through 20, we finish out this section. It says this, as we kind of get the last thought of this section. Starting in verse 18, it says, "What use is a carved idol after its craftsman carves it? It is only a cast image, a teacher of lies. For the one who crafts its shape trusts in it and makes worthless idols that cannot speak. Woe to him who says to wood, 'Wake up,' or to mute stone, 'Come alive.' Can it teach? Look, it may be plated with gold and silver, yet there is no breath in it at all. But the Lord is in the holy temple. Let the whole earth be silent in his presence." So these last few verses, I wanted to read them together because they're all about the same idea and they're all kind of hammering home the same point. The focus here now shifts to Babylon's idol worship, or their worship of these false gods. See, Babylon worshipped many gods, and they would often make these kind of physical idols that are being described here as being carved out of wood or stone. And this isn't just brought up to simply condemn idol worship or condemn the worship of false gods, but rather what's happening here is this is meant to encourage the people of Judah that the God that they worship was far more powerful than the gods that the Babylonians worshipped. This isn't just meant to say these gods aren't real or they shouldn't be worshiping these gods. What this is brought up to say is, look at these gods that these Babylonians worship and how they are lifeless, they are nothing, they're just carved images. And in comparison, look how huge and mighty the God that you worship is, who is real, who is alive, who is a creator, and who, as it says, who the whole earth will be silent in his presence. See, regardless of Judah's faith in God, it would have been hard to look at how powerful and destructive that Babylon was and not wonder if they were getting their power from their gods or if their gods were more powerful than Judah's God, than the God that we worship. And what this verse is telling them is that that's just simply not the case. Their gods are worthless shapes that can't speak, that can't do anything, that can't think. However, the God that Judah worships, the one true God, is very much alive, is very much well, and is so much more powerful than the gods that these Babylonians are making by human hands. So even though it might seem like they have the power of these gods behind them, what we're seeing here is that the God that we worship is real, but is so much more powerful than any god or any idol that is made by human hands, that is carved, because that idol doesn't have breath, that idol doesn't have life. But in comparison, our God is so much more powerful and so much better. So he's saying to Judah, he's saying, don't fear the Babylonians because you're afraid of the power that may have been given to them by their gods that they worship, because their gods aren't real, but our God is real. Your God is real and is so much more powerful than these other gods, and so much more powerful than anything that the Babylonians can imagine. So as we wrap up this section of chapter 2, as we wrap up this section that we're going to cover today, there's three takeaways I want us to kind of walk away with as we close out this section. And the first is this, is that God will deal with the oppressor. God will deal with oppressors. While this message is towards Babylon, we can see that God will deal with those that oppress others for their own gain. And this is an idea that God doesn't take lightly. We see him time and time again that oppressing those that are weaker or defenseless is something that God deals with seriously. God will deal with the oppressor. Second thing we can see, similarly, is that God cares for the oppressed. God cares for the oppressed. He's hearing these cries from Habakkuk. He's hearing about what the people of Judah are and all these other nations that are being oppressed by Babylon, what they're hearing and what they're going through, what they're saying. The reason that God deals with the oppressor is because he cares for the oppressed. We see this throughout the Old Testament. We see this throughout the New Testament. God cares for the weak and defenseless. He cares for those that rely on him. And using power and wealth and status to oppress somebody else is not something that God deals with lightly. God will deal with the oppressor because God cares for the oppressed. And the last thing we can see from this section is that God doesn't desire to punish, but desires for the world to know him. So often people claim that God, specifically when looking at the God of the Old Testament, which is the same God, but looking at the kind of situation that God deals with in the Old Testament, so many people say and claim that he's just interested in punishment, that he's an angry God, that he's a vengeful God, that all he cares about is hurting people or punishing people that don't follow his will or don't follow things exactly how he wants, and all he cares about is punishment. However, that's just not the case. That's just not the case. Certainly, there are many times when sin needs to be dealt with, as we see, and we even see him dealing with Babylon here, and we're going to see him, or eventually, he does punish Babylon for the things that they did. However, his mission is that the world would come to know him, not that the world would just be punished into submission or punished because of the things that they do. God wants for us to know him. He wants a personal relationship with you. He wants a personal relationship with me and with every one of us. That is his main desire. His main desire is not to punish. He doesn't desire to punish people, but his desire is that the world would know him and have a personal relationship with him. And that's what we see today in Habakkuk chapter 2, verses 6 through 20.